Welcome to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility, an ongoing inquiry into American political origins and evolving institutions. The executive director of the Virtual Center is Dr. Bill O'Brien. He's also your host for this continuing conversation. Here he is now, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Thank you, Agnes, and welcome to this Tuesday edition of the Virtual Center for Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. Today is the 12th day of February in the year 2019. Actually, today is the anniversary of the birth of Abraham Lincoln. You don't see much of it now because we created President's Day to encompass all these February birthdays. But if you have a memory, and I have, you know, as a historian, I can remember things from a long time ago, but I can't remember things from 10 minutes ago. That's my problem. But I remember years ago, before President's Day was created, in the years that I was in school, growing up in high school, there was a big issue because the 22nd of February is George Washington's birthday. And the 12th was Lincoln's. And we got a week off in school for Washington's birthday and not Lincoln's. And there was some question all the time as to why that was true and why was Washington considered more important than Lincoln, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, I think part of the idea behind President's Day was to resolve that controversy. And, of course, actually what it did was create a national holiday, which some people advocate, you know, quite a bit. But the fact of the matter is I've always remembered those dates. So, and of course, in the middle, in the 14th, 2 days from now, is Valentine's Day, which in many ways is a much more important day than either one of those birthday anniversaries. But we'll, you know, I think what the day symbolizes is a lot more important than celebrating those birthdays. But of course, we have to realize that the flower industry and the candy industry are the ones that really benefit from Valentine's Day. But anyway, we won't be on the air on Valentine's Day. So since I've mentioned it, let me wish all of you today a happy Abraham Lincoln's birthday celebration, and day after tomorrow, a happy Valentine's Day. Welcome to this Tuesday edition of our get-together. I was telling Agnes, we were chatting before we went on the air. Here we are, 2 days in a row and one more day to go. So we might be able to get a full weekend this week. Let's hope so. Let me give you the phone numbers that will take you directly into the studios and on the air immediately if you do that. If you are so inclined, if you have questions or a concern or a comment or a statement that you would like to make and share with our other listeners, this is an opportunity for you to do it. All you need to do is select one of two phone numbers. Both of them are the same. Both of them will get you into the studios, and Agnes will get you on the air immediately. Both numbers have the same area code, 304. The first number, 304-574-8178, 304-574-8178. The second number, 304-640-2829, 640-2829. If you'd like to communicate directly with me, either by email or through our Facebook page, that's a way that you can get a comment directly to me. I then will use, you know, a little bit of discretion as if it seems that your comment is something that our other listeners would benefit from hearing, then I'll get it on the air for you with your permission, of course. But you can direct these comments to me. If you'd like to do it with an email, that would be fine because I do check my email at least once a day, sometimes a little bit more than that. My email address is waobrien906@gmail.com. waobrien, O-B-R-I-E-N, 906@gmail.com. If you'd like to use Facebook to make your comment, and I know so many of us are on Facebook these days that this might be an easier lift for many of us. I think a lot of us are gradually getting away from the idea of emails. I think those of us, those among us who are, let's say, a little bit older, are kind of hanging on to the email way of communication, whereas others have gone to something else. And many of those folks are on Facebook. We have a Facebook page, as you know. And if you go to Facebook.com, you'll see a search box at the top. And if you type in the name of this program, the Virtual Center for Study of the Constitution, you'll be onto our Facebook page, and you'll see some postings there. The last one, I think, the most recent one, the first one that you would see, deals with free community colleges in West Virginia, as I remember. I put it on there toward the end of last week. And I do intend over the next couple of days to put at least one, maybe a couple additional comments on our Facebook page. I've been derelict in doing that. I acknowledge that. But the fact of the matter is the postings, the Facebook account is still there. The postings are still there. And at the end of each posting, there's a comment button along with a share button. The comment button gives you the opportunity to send a comment directly to me. And ostensibly, it would be about the particular posting that accompanies the comment link. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. If you make a comment, I'll get an immediate notice on my Facebook account that there has been a comment made to one of the postings on our Facebook account. And then Facebook will lead me directly to that posting and your comment. And that would give me an opportunity to respond or to bring it on the air or whatever. The point is, we would love to hear from you, and I look forward to hearing from you. So with that, I'd like to maybe get into our program a little bit today. I want to, kind of touch upon a few things that have occurred since yesterday's program, mainly the dueling rallies in El Paso, Texas last evening. Also, the fact that the president, after he left El Paso last night and came back to Washington, as we speak right now, the president is chairing a cabinet meeting in the White House. And before we came on the air, just a few minutes, 10 minutes before we came on the air, I was looking at television and there was live coverage of this cabinet meeting, although the meeting hadn't started yet. At the very beginning, before it began, President Trump was responding to questions from the media. And so for a few minutes, I left it on, and he was – one of the questions that he was asked more than anything else, of course, was in response to the deal, the negotiated deal that the bipartisan committee trying to avoid a shutdown agreed to last evening. And apparently what they're going to do today is put that agreement into legal language, into something more formal. It has to pass both the Senate and the House of Representatives, and then the president has to sign it. One has to presume that since it was bipartisan, Senator Shelby of Alabama was chairing the group, and I think the Democratic leader was Nita Lowry from Congresswoman from New York. But the fact that it was bipartisan, the fact that Nancy Pelosi has already signed off on it, suggests that it will pass the Democratic House. One has to assume that since Senator Shelby chaired the group, chances are more than likely that Mitch McConnell will call for a vote on the floor of the Senate. And one has to conclude that it's likely to pass there because of the bipartisan nature of the negotiations and the agreement. both sides went into these negotiations indicating clearly that they would accept whatever came out. The question, of course, is going to be President Trump. And he's very noncommittal as to whether, in fact, he will accept it or not. When asked by a one of the journalists, one of the reporters in the room, in the cabinet room where the meeting was taking place, whether he thought there was going to be a shutdown, the president was a little bit less than enthusiastic about the possibility. I think the handwriting is on the wall. I think he realizes that the last shutdown, which was blamed for most part directly on him, he took a beating, a political beating, on the last shutdown. And as I mentioned yesterday, CNN reports that the refusal of 10 air traffic controllers, 6 in New York and 4 in Florida, to come to work on the 35th day, and what it did to America's air traffic on that morning, CNN reports, was probably the major impetus in getting President Trump to call a halt to the shutdown after 35 days. The fact of the matter is he took a beating on it. And of course, if you remember the meeting in the Oval Office a few weeks ago, in which the president told Chuck Schumer that he would take total responsibility if there was a shutdown, and that he was proud to shut down the government in the interests of national security, and he was more than willing to take the heat for it, and he even said, "I will not blame you, I promise." The fact that it ended up that way, that he did take most of the heat for it, I think is something that bothers him a little bit. What was very clear to me today, he made it clear he doesn't want another shutdown. And then he said something that I think you have to kind of interpret a little bit. He said, if there is another shutdown, then it's going to be totally on the Democrats. This one will be totally on the Democrats. Now, the fact of the matter is, if there's a shutdown, President Trump is going to do it. The Democrats aren't going to do it. Trump will do it. So the question is, how do you square his idea that it's going to be a Democratic shutdown if there is one, when in fact he's the one that will call it? And the only conclusion that one can reach, at least the one that I reached, was if he can find a way to pin it totally on the Democrats this time, there's liable to be one. But that's going to be very difficult. So chances are it probably won't happen. But on the other hand, he continues to rail about the wall. And if you saw the reports on the meeting, on the rally in El Paso last evening, the president was told on his way onto the stage that a tentative deal had been struck in Washington amongst the bipartisan negotiators. And they told him basically what was involved in it, and the Democrats had given a little bit. But on the other hand, there was less money appropriated for border security than was on the table going in. The president obviously said that he was less than enthused about this deal, but then he made the comment and said, the wall's going to be built anyway. And so one had to conclude from that, from his comments last night, that he seems to be leaning towards the idea of declaring a national emergency to build the wall. It's hard to tell, because today at the cabinet meeting before it started, he made the comment that he was less than enthused over this deal. because conspicuously the deal does not include money for a wall. It basically appropriates in the area of $1 billion towards border security and fencing, but specifically never uses the never mentions a wall, which the president insisted had to be there in order for him to approve it. So whether, in fact, it passes the House and the Senate or not almost seems insignificant or immaterial, but it has to do that before it gets to the president's desk. And it's a little bit unclear as to whether, in fact, he's going to approve it or not. But I think it's very interesting. It speaks to how political this whole thing is. But I wanted to spend a moment on the meeting in El Paso last night, because this was not only a meeting over border security. This was, and a number of pundits in the media say have said pretty much the same thing. This was effectively the kickoff to the president's 2020 reelection campaign. And I think it's particularly interesting that it happened on the Monday after Elizabeth Warren's statement in Iowa the day before, this past Sunday, raising the possibility that when the 2020 election comes around, President Trump may not even be president anymore. And then she followed that up with a statement, he may not even be a free person anymore. And 24 hours later, President Trump is initiating his 2020 reelection campaign with a rally in El Paso. And he made the statement that he made in a number of his other rallies. Is there anything more fun than being at a Trump rally? I think it's very interesting that even he calls it a rally. In theory, it was a way to promote his wall. That's why the thing was called in the first place. But the fact of the matter is, all of these meetings with his supporters end up being rallies. And the reason for that is that the president never adheres to a script. When he appears before these groups and the magic of a large audience on him with people chanting about the wall and about Trump and about the USA and all these other things, when they get fired up, President Trump gets fired up. And when he gets fired up, he goes off script. And when he goes off script and speaks off the cuff, he has a way of interacting and connecting with these positive crowds that's infectious. I have never been, I have no intention of attending a Trump rally. On the other hand, the one aspect of attending a Trump rally that interests me is to watch it happen and get a measure of the electricity between him and the crowd. Because he does have a talent for speaking before a group and saying the things they want to hear and inflaming them, et cetera, et cetera. So for a long time, when would have these meetings, these presentations, they always seem to become a rally. And the media always reports them as a rally. And now Donald Trump has taken to calling them a rally himself. So I think that's pretty informative. I think that tells us an awful lot. That's really what brings him alive, what makes him tick. And I think it's important. Not the evidence, not the facts, none of that. It's the electricity of that crowd and what it does to him and for him. that I think is the, you know, is the most significant issue here. The fact of the matter is he continues to lie. The reports coming from El Paso are that the alternative March for Freedom that Beto O'Rourke set up in opposition to President Trump's rally happening simultaneously, according to the reports, drew somewhere between 10 and 15,000 people. President Trump packed the Coliseum in which his meeting was scheduled. The seating capacity in that theater, in that Coliseum, is reported to have been, it's reported to be 6,700 people. 6,700 people gathered in one place is a lot of people. And the reports are that there were several hundred who couldn't get in, but were there on the outside and wanting to get in and all of that. So there was a significant crowd of Trump supporters at his rally. But when he got on the stage, he basically suggested that his crowd was close to 35,000, whereas only 200 people attended the other, or were attending the other, because it was going on at the same time. So in other words, the facts never slow down the lies. He just continues to say not only what he wants to say, but most important, what the people there want to hear. He's feeding them. And to do it, whether what he says is true or not, seems not to matter one iota. And the fact of the matter is, he wins. I read one column this morning that was addressing the situation in El Paso last evening, and it pointed out how many local groups and business people were getting behind the competing rally organized by Beto O'Rourke. Because the fact of the matter is, President Trump's comments about El Paso being a high crime city, a dangerous city, until the wall was built, is a total lie. And the fact of the matter is, all the data has been put out there. And El Paso was always considered one of America's safest cities, even before the wall was built in 2008. But beginning in 2006, and extending for a couple of years beyond 2008 to 2010, 2011, crime in El Paso increased somewhat. I've seen a number of 17%. So in a sense, the facts are that El Paso was never considered a dangerous city. It's always been considered one of America's safest cities. Before the wall, after the wall. Except for this brief period when crime increased. More important than that, there's a flow of traffic back and forth between Juarez and El Paso, across the bridges over the Rio Grande. People cross it to work, to go to school, to do business, to visit, whatever. The president's comments and insistence on continuing such comments is costing El Paso money. It's having a negative impact on business there. One report I read this morning said that there's as much as $70 million worth of business and commerce that goes on between Mexico and the United States in the area of El Paso and Juarez. And many business people in El Paso who do business there are really upset because the president's continued insistence that it was that it's a high crime area, it was a high crime area before the wall, is doing damage to the economy of the region. Despite all of this, and despite the enthusiastic opposition to President Trump and what he was saying about El Paso, even by the mayor, the fact of the matter is President Trump wasn't deterred at all from saying what he wanted to say and what those people in that crowd wanted to hear. He had 35,000 in his audience. Beto O'Rourke only had a couple hundred. When the fact is, both crowds were sizable. But it appeared that Beto O'Rourke's was a little bit at least larger. 10,000, possibly up to 12, 13,000. Whereas President Trump's was limited to about 6,700 plus 300 or 400 others. So I don't think anybody's berating a crowd of 7,000 people. The fact of the matter is, however, that there's one other factor that I think one has to consider here. And that is that while Texas is a red state, and while there's a lot of support for President Trump in Texas, the El Paso area is one area where the president is not going to get a lot of support. Yet 7,000 people approximately showed up in support with Make America Great Again hats and chants and all the rest of it. But the reports are that people were driving from Arizona, California, and other places, sometimes as much as 900 miles, to attend this rally. So in other words, all the people in his audience were not local people. A lot of them were transplants from other areas. So I think that's important to acknowledge as well, because this is not a Trump support, an area of Trump support. This particular area of Texas, clearly, this is the district that Beto O'Rourke represented in Congress before he gave that seat up to run for the Senate against Ted Cruz. So this is not a Trump area of Texas at all. So I think that's very, very significant. I wanted to get into one other issue, and then I want to get into the issue of the blackface stuff that we started to touch upon yesterday. But like each day, you almost have to deal with a few of these things, because the one thing we can say about the Trump administration is that not a day goes by that there isn't at least one, and more often than not, more than one event that you'd be remiss in a program like ours to not comment upon. So therefore, even though you have a plan and you have a major issue on the agenda, the fact is sometimes it takes, you know, almost half or perhaps two-thirds of the first hour of our time together before we get to the main item of the day. Well, this isn't the main hour item of the day, but I wanted to share it with you. I'm guessing that many of you may be familiar with this anyway. I wasn't until last week. I came across it last week in an article in the New York Times by Thomas Edsel. And Thomas Edsel quoted a significant portion of this. and then basically built a pretty lengthy and informative piece around it about what's happening in what's happening politically, both on the left and on the right, to deal with the realities of what this particular statement or presentation was about. I don't want to spend time necessarily going into the pros and cons. It's a pretty solid argument. But I don't want to not deal with the issue and therefore not at least share the presentation or the statement or the comments that led to the article, because I think they are significant. This dates to the first of the year, namely January 2nd, more than a month ago, a month and 10 days ago, on Fox News. It was a monologue by Tucker Carlson, one of the premier conservative media superstars on Fox News. And there's no question that in terms of size of audience, Tucker Carlson is competing on Fox News with Sean Hannity, because Sean Hannity is kind of at the top of the heap in terms of the size of his audience, but also with Rachel Maddow on MSNBC and others. So he's in search of audience, he's in search of media attention, all the rest of it. The reason I say all that is because I was stunned when I read the statement he made. And I was not stunned by the fact that the comment or the monologue that he presented on January 2nd rippled through the conservative media population and raised all sorts of questions like, what is Tucker Carlson about? In fact, Edsel, in his article, points out that one of the people who responded to Tucker Carlson's monologue claims that he, for the next couple of weeks, followed Tucker Carlson every night in order to see whether the message that is in this monologue was consistent with his way of thinking. And the fact of the matter is, he never mentioned it again, at least for the next 2 or 3 weeks after January 2nd. So one has to wonder about this one particular monologue, which was so out of character for him. This is what struck me, because it was so much out of character. Let me share, and I'm quoting from Thomas Edsel's presentation, from the particular document itself. I have not gone on the internet to get the total monologue. I've been satisfied with the extensive coverage that Edsel gives it. But with that caveat, let me at least share with you what Edsel gives us. Tucker Carlson made the following comment. The goal for America is both simpler and more elusive than mere prosperity. Dignity, purpose, self-control, independence, above all, deep relationships with other people. And then, after that provocative statement about what America is all about, Carlson says, Our leaders don't care. We are ruled by mercenaries who feel no long-term obligation to the people they rule. They're day traders, substitute teachers. They're just passing through. They have no skin in this game, and it shows. They can't solve our problems. They don't even bother to understand our problems. By this point, I'm stunned. Because I never thought I'd hear this coming out of the mouth of Tucker Carlson. Then he goes on. The idea that families are being crushed by market forces seems never to occur to them. They refuse to consider it. Questioning markets feels like apostasy. Both sides miss the obvious point. Culture and economics are inseparably intertwined. Certain economic systems allow families to thrive. Thriving families make market economies possible. Now I've moved beyond stunned to wow. I can't believe that I'm reading this. The idea that families are being crushed by market forces seems never to occur to them, to our leaders. They refuse to consider it. Questioning markets feels like apostasy. Both sides miss the obvious point. Culture and economics are inseparably intertwined. Certain economic systems allow families to thrive. Thriving families make market economies possible. And then he specifically begins to touch on specific problems faced by rural white America, which, of course, is the crucial base of the Republican Party. It's what most people believe got Donald Trump elected. Carlson says, stunning out of wedlock birth rates, high male unemployment, a terrifying drug epidemic. How, Carlson says, how did this happen? You'd think our ruling classes would be interested in knowing the answer. But mostly they're not. They don't have to be interested. It's easier to import foreign labor to take the place of native-born Americans who are slipping behind. And then Carlson, even though he's pointed out where conservatives are failing, basically begins to support the Republican Party as the only solution to this problem. He says, there's no option at this point. But first, Republican leaders have to acknowledge that market capitalism is not a religion. I had to do a double take on that one. Republican leaders have to acknowledge that market capitalism is not a religion. Market capitalism is a tool, like a staple gun or a toaster. You'd have to be a fool to worship it. Our system was created by human beings for the benefit of human beings. We do not exist to serve markets, just the opposite. Any economic system that weakens and destroys families is not worth having. A system like that is the enemy of a healthy society. Unquote. I never thought I would hear Tucker Carlson say this. And from the reports later on in this article, he apparently never said it again. Republican leaders have to acknowledge that market capitalism is not a religion. Market capitalism is a tool like a staple gun or a toaster. You'd have to be a fool to worship it. Our system was created by human beings for the benefit of human beings. We do not exist to serve markets. Just the opposite. Any economic system that weakens and destroys families is not worth having. A system like that is the enemy of a healthy society. That seems to me to come closer to a criticism of Republican priorities as anything I've ever heard. And it was on Fox News on January 2nd. No wonder conservatives took note. No wonder shockwaves rippled through the conservative establishment. Tucker Carlson was raising the question and implying clearly that too many Republicans treat market capitalism as if it was a religion. And his point is that it's not a religion. It's a tool. It's a tool created by human beings for human beings. Its purpose is to allow for thriving families. If families are not thriving, then that system is not worth supporting, is what he said. Wow. In response to this, David French, senior writer at the National Review, which is the conservative publication, criticized Carlson's statement a bit. He didn't reject it. What he did say was, even if you accept what Tucker Carlson says, quote, it's still true that your choices are far more important to your success than any government program or the actions of any nefarious banker or any malicious feminist, unquote. In other words, the National Review's response is not outright rejection, but a reaffirmation of the fact that the free market, even if it's tainted, gives us the best chance. So that's an effort to pull Tucker Carlson back a little bit from across the center line back into the conservative fold. But the fact of the matter is, the monologue is there. He said it. People reacted to it. Thomas Edsel, on the 6th of February, which was 6 days ago, be a week tomorrow, in the New York Times, put together a whole article about it and cites a number of different sources from Salon and other places. But the fact of the matter is, politically, what Carlson is alluding to, it seems to me, is the plight of rural white, relatively uneducated, non-college-going citizens living in the heartland. President Trump's base, the reason that President Trump was elected president, the essence of the president's continually existing base It may be shrinking a bit based on his behavior, actions, and statements, but it's still there. It's not powerful enough to win control of the country, but it's powerful enough to control the Republican agenda. And as long as it exists, and as long as President Trump is able to convince this group that he and only he has their best interests at heart, they will continue to support him. When they don't, it's over. I just could not let another week go by without sharing that particular January 2nd Fox News monologue by Tucker Carlson with you. It's astounding, given the fact that he said it. I think it's amazing. I'd like to touch on what I think is liable to be the main point of today's program. We introduced it yesterday in the last 20 minutes of our second hour, and I mentioned that we'll be returning to it today because it's so critical, and it's linked to the blackface issue. And let me begin. I do want to touch upon a few things I said yesterday because I think hopefully they're going to emerge as very important in some of the things I want to share with you and get you to think about. Because everything I say, I want you to think about. I'm not trying to tell anybody anything. I'm sharing ideas and thoughts and questions. I think that this is one of the most important issues that this nation has to face, the issue of racism. I believe it's an issue that has always been with us as a nation, yet it remains an issue that we really haven't faced, not directly. We thought we put it to rest, but it turns out we haven't. It turns out that it's there. It was repressed for a long time because most of it is embarrassing and inappropriate. Not the kind of thing that too many people want to be associated with. Racist ideas, racist sentiments, racist thoughts. But what we've seen clearly in the last 3+ years since Donald Trump emerged on the national political stage is that under the right circumstances, given the right messenger who's willing to set a tone which seems to send the subtle message to everybody that it's okay to say what's within you that you want to say and that you don't have to be embarrassed about it. And the fact that so much revealing this nascent racism has come to the fore over the last few years indicates that even though we thought we had resolved it, all we did was repress it. All we did was to create a strong enough alternative cultural set of priorities that it sent the message to people that this kind of stuff was inappropriate. But it never resolved it. It was never dealt with head on in a way that would make people realize why it's wrong and why we can no longer afford in any form to harbor it or endorse it, let alone endorse it, just harbor it. Left unattended or unaddressed, I believe it's going to destroy us. Because it violates everything that this nation stands for. It's all around us in one way or the other. It's at the heart of the conflict and the debates over immigration. It's always been there. Even though we tend to put it in terms which separate it from racism, it never becomes totally separated. I don't believe. In yesterday's program, I shared a few personal thoughts from my own experience. Why I think the blackface issue is so important is it symbolizes the whole issue of racism in America and how deep it goes. It's one significant symbol of a racism that is always there, but much broader. It's getting a lot of attention now because of the political situation in Virginia. I've begun to conclude that if there's one mistake in all of this debate, it's the emphasis on Virginia. Because this whole issue is sending a message that the problem is not America's problem, it's Virginia's problem. That there's something unique about Virginia and Virginia history that makes this a Virginia problem. And the implication is, it's an issue that Virginians are going to have to solve. I think that's a mistake. I think it goes way beyond Virginia. It covers all aspects, all parts of the nation. All of us. It raises serious questions about the idea we don't have a race problem here. Because in our area, we're predominantly one race. The fact of the matter is, whether you live in an area of the country which is multiracial, multilingual, multinational, which principally is on the coasts, on the East Coast or the West Coast, and not in the heartland. The fact of the matter is, it's a problem that all of us need to deal with and confront. And this is what the blackface issue over the last couple of weeks in Virginia has told me, or has taught me, I believe. And this is just me. It is my feeling that the reason that the blackface issue in Virginia is getting the attention, national attention, and undoubtedly international attention as well, that it is because it has peeled away the scab over a wound that has never really healed. The reason that this nation, I believe, has never directly confronted and taken on this issue is not only because it's explosive, not only because it's political dynamite, not only because it's difficult to deal with, I believe the reason the nation hasn't taken it on directly as yet is because the nation as a nation doesn't even realize it's there. And I count myself in my past as evidence of this. I shared with you yesterday at the end of our program that I can remember as a child, as a teenager, going to an annual minstrel show in my community in a local elementary school that was held every year. I can't remember who sponsored it. I can't remember what the purpose was. All I remember is we used to go. It was fun. It was a good time. The music was great. Everybody that I knew went. I mean, many of the people there I knew. None of us, myself included, none of us thought for a second that there was anything wrong with this. Because it was there. It was all around us. Everybody participated in it. Nobody criticized it. This obviously was before the civil rights movement. So nobody made excuses. Nobody raised questions about whether, in fact, it was appropriate or not. Nobody raised questions as to how badly, how much this, how cruel this was to African Americans, how insensitive, how cruel. Nobody raised that question. African Americans didn't raise it. Caucasian Americans didn't raise it. Nobody raised it. Therefore, there wasn't a problem. So therefore, it was never mentioned. I believe that's the message. The reason we've never confronted the race issue in this country is because it is so deep and so pervasive and has become such a part of our culture, of our heritage, of our upbringing, of our history. It's there in so many ways, in so many facets, in so many aspects of our lives, that it's not there. We don't see it. It's just what is. And it's terribly wrong. I'm embarrassed that I was not able to even see how it might be wrong. None of us were. This is what can happen when wrong becomes so pervasive that it ceases to be wrong anymore. It's like the issue today of facts with President Trump and Marianne Conway's idea of alternative facts. It speaks to the lies coming out of the White House. The stream is endless. It never stops. There isn't enough hard evidence to stop the flow of lies. The result is that if they continue to come and you can't stop them, then they cease to be lies anymore. there ceases to be truth anymore. Facts are no longer facts. They become one aspect of the facts. But at the same time, they come with an alternative set of facts and create the message that there is no longer anything, such a thing as truth. What I see in the racial issue is that we have reached a point in this society where when it comes to the issue of race, right and wrong have ceased to mean anything. Wrong has become right because it's so plentiful. It's all around us. All of us have become indoctrinated into the realities of wrong to the point that nobody dares or is willing to call out wrong anymore because it's so pervasive that nobody sees it or recognizes it. It just becomes part of what is. It's time we move beyond that. And I think we can. When we get into our second hour, I want to pause in a moment because I've gone beyond the top of the hour already. But after we take our break, I want to get into with you an article written by an historian at Princeton University on blackface, on what she calls minstrelism, amateur minstrelism in American society, just to give you an idea as to how pervasive, how much this has become part of our heritage and our culture. All of it leads to the conclusion that if it doesn't exist, then it ceases to be wrong. And if you are so overwhelmed by it, if it is so pervasive that it's everywhere, then wrong ironically becomes right. Somebody needs to call it out. Somebody needs to identify it as for what it is. Let me conclude this before we take our break with this one idea or one thought. As I was putting this together in my mind, as I was thinking about this and how it would be presented, I'm aware that it's sensitive. I'm aware that it's explosive. But I'm also aware that it's so damn serious. That it has to be addressed. It has to be. So with that, let's pause and take a short break. We're at 4 minutes after the hour, so we'll take three or four or five minutes, whatever. And then we'll come back and we'll get into this. And I want to share with you some of the historical evidence that this particular Princeton historian puts together. Just on the issue of blackface. But again, we're focusing on that one issue of blackface. But it symbolizes something much bigger, much broader, much more important, and much more dangerous. And the fact is, you can't undo the danger until you recognize that there is a danger. And her evidence, it seems to me, makes the degree or the extent of that danger evident. We can no longer pretend it's not there. We can no longer avoid dealing with it. You're listening to the Virtual Center for Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. We're at 5 minutes after the hour, 5 minutes after two in the East. We're going to pause and take a short break, and then we'll be back and we'll pursue this topic. Please stay with us. It's so important. Thank you.
now return to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. Here's your host, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Well, thank you, Agnes, and welcome to our second hour on this Tuesday edition of the Virtual Center for Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. Our break went about a minute longer than it usually does today. We actually were almost 6 minutes in our break. I think it took me a little bit longer today to get – I just need a little bit of time between the first hour and the second hour. This particular topic is a tough one. It's a tough one in so many ways. But again, I think it's so important that it's worth pursuing. If you'd like to weigh in on this or other topics that we've dealt with, then I do invite you to call in, and I mean that, because what we don't do today, we can always do tomorrow. So please don't feel that the agenda is set in concrete, and if you call, you'd be interrupting or changing the chain of thought or something like that. Please don't think that. We have two phone numbers that will get you directly into the studios, and Agnes will get you on the air immediately. The first, both of them are the same area code, 304. The first number is 304-574-8178. The second number, 304-640-2829. Or if you'd like to direct your comment to me, you can do that either via our Facebook page or in an email directly to me. My email address is waobrien906@gmail.com. Our Facebook page, I think, is something that most of us by now have become familiar with. If you go to the homepage at Facebook, facebook.com, you'll see a search box at the top. And if you type in the name of this program, the Virtual Center for Study of the Constitution, you'll be onto our Facebook page and you'll see a series of postings there. And at the end of each posting, you'll see a comment link. And if you click that comment link, it gives you an opportunity to comment, to direct a comment directly to me. In theory, it would be about that particular posting, but I just have tried to suggest to you that that's not necessarily so. I'll read your comment, and it can be about that particular posting, but it doesn't have to be. So that's a way, other than email, that you can direct a comment directly to me. But if you'd like to share your thoughts with our other listeners and like to do it yourself, and I could understand that, then by calling in, you can accomplish that. So with that, let me return to our subject. We have 45 minutes or a little bit more than that left to us in this hour. So I wanted to get back into the issue of the blackface controversy. And I think the point that I already made, for those of you just joining us, we're into an issue that I had mentioned at the end of the program yesterday that we'd be into today. And we're just really getting into the substance of it now. One of the points that I made just prior to break, and I think it's important to reemphasize it and mention it again, I think Virginia is taking an unfair hit in this controversy that's going on right now about blackface by the governor, by the attorney general, and even by the Republican Speaker of the House. Not the Speaker of the House. Let me be a little bit more honest here. The Senate Majority Leader of the Virginia Senate, Tommy Norment, has admitted, he's a Republican, and he admitted in the height of this, that as editor of his 1968 college yearbook, it was filled with blackface photos, and he was the editor for the yearbook. So the fact of the matter is, there's a lot going on here. And I think the message that I wanted to convey, is that this goes way beyond Virginia. It's not only, I think, a little bit unfair to pin it exclusively on Virginia, but it's a little bit dishonest to do that. Because by linking it to Virginia, it lets the rest of us off scot-free. This issue is so important, we can't afford to do that. That's one thing that I think is important so far before we even go on. A second thing that is equally important, and I have to say this, because I don't think I ever really fully appreciated before exactly what I'm going to say. Over the last week and a half, since I started reading about this Virginia controversy over the blackface and the pressure on leading politicos in the state to resign over it, only during this time have I really begun to appreciate what it is that leaders of the civil rights movement were up against. I had no idea what an uphill battle these folks took on. Because what they were trying to do was educate the nation on a problem that the nation never really knew was even there. They should have known, but they didn't know. The issue was removed from our history. Our schools don't teach it. One of the things that bothers me about education is that our sensitivity to the issue of discrimination, of violations of the First Amendment, has caused our educational establishment to duck anything that even comes close to the religious issue for fear of doing something that's wrong or unconstitutional or illegal or anything like that. We've ducked it. And the result is that by doing that, we have eliminated anything related to the spiritual from our K through 12 educational systems and from our higher education system as well. We've become so sensitive, so concerned about possible violations to the First Amendment that we've shied away from anything that even resembles the issue of spirituality. When the reality is that we know that an important part of development, of human development, an important part about what every one of us is about in this country is spirituality. Recognizing fully what makes human beings human, what makes them unique, what makes them in the eyes of so many, man's creation in the image of God. It's so much a part of every individual's makeup, psychological makeup. It touches so many aspects of the lives of every one of us that to totally ignore it and exclude it from the curriculum or from the agenda of our educational establishment does a tremendous disservice to all of us, to the individuals in this society and to the society as a whole. The same thing is true with this issue. Just as we have pretended in the educational arena that there's no such thing as spirituality when we know in fact there is, so also, we've become convinced that nothing is wrong if nobody speaks to the degree to which it's wrong. In other words, if nobody identifies it, then it ceases to be there. What a monumental challenge to people involved in civil rights. Look what they had to overcome. They not only had to change people's attitudes and change people's minds, they literally had to bring to the fore of people's consciousness what people didn't even know was there. Before they could point out what was wrong, they had to point out that it was there. Because racism in this country had become so pervasive, so all-encompassing, so much a part of everybody's day-to-day life, that it ceased to be even recognizable. Think about trying to change something like that. With that, let me go back. I mentioned this yesterday. It is an article that appeared in the Washington Post. The author is Ray Lynn Barnes, Ray, R-H-A-E, assistant professor of American cultural history at Princeton University. The author of a forthcoming book called Darkology, When the American Dream Wore Blackface. This article begins with an account of the Virginia political situation. Governor Ralph Northam, Attorney General Mark Herring, both of whom have admitted that they wore blackface as students in the 1980s. And then a few days later, the Republican Virginia Senate Majority Leader Tommy Norment admitted that he was editor of a college yearbook in 1968 that was filled with blackface photos. What the situation suggests, if you stand back far enough to totally embrace all of it, is that it's not party specific, it's not state specific. It's an issue that involves all of us. Let me share with you the third paragraph of Dr. Barnes's article, or op-ed, because I think it speaks volumes. She says, "Blackface is as American as the ruling class. Throughout the 20th century, all male fraternal orders, schools, federal agencies, and the U.S. military collectively institutionalized the practice. All of these areas, fraternal orders, schools, federal agencies, the military, helped to institutionalize racism in this country, as reflected in blackface. Watching blackface performances was a common pastime for U.S. presidents from both parties. Blacking up was seen as an expression of cultural heritage and patriotism throughout the Jim Crow era in America, an era named after a famous blackface character. And up until the civil rights movement. Even now," she says, "a recent poll conducted by YouGov finds that only 58% of Americans think there's anything wrong with it." In other words, it's a majority, 58%. But that means that 42% of the population doesn't believe that there's anything wrong with it. She claims that she has specialized in the history of what she calls amateur blackface minstrelsy. And here's what her research has entailed. She said, I spent a decade, 10 years, poring over blackface composites from yearbooks and fraternal orders, watching film footage, cataloging more than 10,000 blackface plays, collecting and preserving discarded programs, scrapbooks, photographs, how-to guides on blackface from library sales, antique auctions, abandoned boxes outside foreclosed homes. And then she basically makes a statement about the significance of her research. The reaction to the news coming out of Virginia shows how deeply the history of blackface has been buried, along with the practice itself. Once central to American popular culture, minstrelsy after the Civil Rights Movement became taboo. Once African-American activists began to fight against it in the 60s and 70s. The truth is that it's impossible to look anywhere without seeing it everywhere. That's how pervasive it has become. Blackface, she says, originated in northern cities in the 1830s before the Civil War. It quickly became popular in Virginia. And then she gives a little bit of Virginia's historical legacy here. Virginia, which had imported enslaved Africans as early as 1619, embodied the complex relationship between blackface entertainment, slavery, and American culture. In other words, all of it came together, it seems, in Virginia. But it became so pervasive that by the middle of the 20th century, it was everywhere. And then she focuses attention on the flagship university in Virginia, the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Mr. Jefferson's University. And she points out some things about the University of Virginia that I didn't know. I think they are extremely revealing. She says that things changed in Virginia with the Civil War because one thing that came out of that war was the reality that the school, the University of Virginia, quote, could no longer rely on income from hiring out enslaved people it owned to work on nearby plantations. That the University of Virginia, prior to the Civil War, owned slaves that at least to plantations in that region, which brought income into the University of Virginia. The Civil War ended that. But, as she points out, Virginia replaced it by making blackface a major part of its fundraising strategy. In 1886 and 1887, the university had an official minstrel troupe that traveled around doing musicals and donated its proceeds to the construction of the chapel on the University of Virginia campus, the place where people went to worship God, was funded in large part by a minstrel troupe in blackface that entertained for money to support university projects. I just think the degree to the, of all of this is informative. Blackface was popular beyond the university, she points out. The Ku Klux Klan in Virginia used blackface in raids to confuse victims. The Klan and the United Daughters of the Confederacy used blackface in comedy shows to recruit members. In 1924, Charlottesville erected its famous statue of Robert E. Lee, the taking down of which was the basis of the far-right demonstrations, the white supremacy demonstrations in Charlottesville more than a year ago. And the Charlotte Elks Club ran ads promoting their minstrel show and ridiculing black American soldiers in the military. As late as 1874, the annual Charlottesville Lions Club minstrel show was so popular that it was recommended in travel guidebooks for Virginia. If you pick one of these travel guidebooks of places to see in Virginia, the Lions Club annual minstrel show was in there as late as 1974. But it wasn't just Virginia. She points out that amateur blackface quickly spread to the north and into the west. In 1968, in New York City, the Elks, commonly referred to as the Burnt Cork Brotherhood, paid homage to the minstrel shows. By the mid-20th century, she says, the Elks Club was the largest fraternal order in the nation. It eventually became segregated, all male, anti-communist business and political network that raised money by relying on blackface to finance thousands of Elks lodges that became focus for political organizing and patriotic social events and civic education. The legacy of the Elks Club and blackface are inextricably intertwined. By the 1960s, the Elks could count presidents as members: Warren G. Harding, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, John F. Kennedy were part of the Elks Brotherhood, as well as generals in the military and senators in the Congress of the United States. Among Elks members, Barry Goldwater, Tip O'Neill, Carl Albert, John McCormick of Massachusetts, Sam Rayburn, Tom Foley, Supreme Court Justice Earl Warren, and more than 60 state governors. No politician, Dr. Barnes says, who was a member of the Elks Club, could pretend ignorance to the strong connections that the Fraternal Order had to white supremacy. In 1970, the Elks voted to maintain their order as racially exclusive, white only. Blackface minstrelsy was part of the Elks initiation process well into the 1970s. And then there were other examples of this. All I wanted to do was demonstrate the pervasiveness of this particular practice. And then she includes things like, for example, Woodrow Wilson on his way back to the country from the Paris Peace Conference at the end of World War I was entertained with an amateur minstrel show aboard the USS George Washington. President Roosevelt was entertained by it. In 1928, President-elect Herbert Hoover and his wife are seen in photographs lapping, clapping, and shaking the hands of U.S. Navy sailors dressed in blackface on the USS Maryland. 1943 musical, This is the Army, introduced a fresh-faced Ronald Reagan, who directed an all-Army minstrel number called Mandy. And then, for American politicians, the Gridiron Dinner in downtown Washington. Basically included a blackface demonstration depicting African Americans from Tuskegee University. President William Howard Taft took a front row seat in 1909 as what the newspapers called America's National Minstrel Show. During Jim Crow's century-long reign in this country, the highly pervasive world of blackface minstrelsy took hold in nearly every city and town in the United States. California hosted more amateur blackface shows per capita than any other state in the country after the Civil War. You can't find, she says, a university yearbook in the first half of the 20th century which doesn't contain evidence of blackface. What happened? Why did it disappear? Why is it that most of us are shocked by what's going on in Virginia because we didn't think this kind of stuff went on anymore? What happened? Dr. Barnes says that the answer to this has to do with one aspect of the civil rights movement that most of us are totally unfamiliar with. And that's the role of black mothers, African American mothers, in the 50s and 60s, who were involved as the wives of black veterans who began to push civil rights in this country and school integration. They began to protest. They were on the front lines against school segregation. Their success meant that young black children for the first time, were going to school with white children. And that's when these mothers were horrified to discover that in the nation's schools were music, poems, literature, and plays that their children were now seeing that were forms of amateur blackface minstrelsy. And these mothers began a national media campaign and filed legal cases in court to ban blackface. And they won. It was these mothers who were so successful at driving blackface out of the mainstream that schools never teach it in teaching history, which is why so many Americans are uninformed about it and why it's so offensive and hurtful to African Americans. In a sense, these women, these mothers, were so successful as part of the civil rights movement that they literally drove blackface out of the schools, out of our communities, and it disappeared until it surfaced again in Virginia in yearbooks that went back into the early 80s. Because in the early 80s, it wasn't quite dead yet. And so as these people go back to college and university yearbooks in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, they're finding evidence of blackface everywhere. So the question is, why weren't these things discovered earlier? Why is it that nothing in the background of Governor Northam or Attorney General Herring or these other people in Virginia, how is it that they got all the way to the top offices in the state of Virginia before any of this stuff surfaced? Why didn't these yearbook photos of Ku Klux Klan outfits and blackface depiction surface earlier? Why didn't our so-called fourth branch of government, the media, why didn't they discover this before? How is it that Herring got all the way into the governor's chair in Virginia before any of this stuff surfaced? And it seems, as you read, that there's two reasons for this. And this I can relate to, because I've even mentioned it earlier on this program. And that is that deep investigative journalism has become more and more invisible in our society. Local journalism, local media outlets have cut back on investigative journalism to the point that they're not catching these people early in their careers. Years ago, if people had evidence, hard evidence, of something like this blackface scandal in a yearbook, in a college yearbook, somebody would have picked it up and turned it over to the local media, to the newspaper, And then it would have been investigated and corroborated. And when it was found to be true, it would have been revealed. Northrop's career would have had to face this long before he ever got to the governor's chair in Virginia. But the fact is, economics has meant the scale back in our major newspapers has meant that investigative journalism has become a rarity in today's media establishment. Nobody has the resources to investigate those things. If you want evidence of this, just think about your local evening news. Almost none of it constitutes investigative journalism. It becomes more an outlet for PR announcements by prominent people in the community who want to get out information about themselves and their organizations. Our local news, for all practical purposes, has become a PR outlet to the general public. It's advertising that doesn't cost anything if you can get on the evening news. If you can get into the local papers, you announce local pancake breakfasts and bean suppers and hot dog suppers and all the rest of it as fundraisers for different organizations and groups in the community. Nothing wrong with any of this. There's nothing wrong with it, except that much of it is a substitute for what used to be, one time, investigative journalism. So consequently, journalism is not picking up on these faux pas in some of our community leaders and upcoming politicians. And they get all the way to the top before any of this stuff surfaces. And then there's one other aspect of this that I think plays into it, and that's social media. Social media gives anybody, any of us, an opportunity to put stuff out on the internet, on Instagram, on Facebook, on YouTube, whether it's true or not. It used to be that journalism screened what went public. And if there was no validity to it, it never surfaced. The general public didn't find out about it. Now they find out about it instantly, even if it's not true. The fact is that by the time we find out that it isn't true, the damage has already been done and reputations, careers have already been short-circuited. Reputations have been ruined. And now the burden of proof is on the person attacked to rebuild their reputation. A combination of cutbacks in investigative journalism and the emergence of social media has meant that everything gets out there. The dirtiest crap on anybody in the world is out there for all to see before anybody has an opportunity to stop it. It's instantaneously in the hands and in the homes of tens of thousands or millions of people. It's a situation tailor-made for selfish, cruel people out to hurt other people. And it puts the burden of proof on all of us as individual citizens to make sure that we don't believe everything we read because it's on the internet or on Facebook. We've got to be careful. We've got to be critical. And that comes all the way back to the issue of the need for good quality education. We have got to be educated in developing the ability to spot fraud, to spot lies, to spot political intent. For example, I think I misspoke when I said, for example, but I wanted to give you – oh, here it is. This is what I wanted to share with you. Northam's blackface photo from his medical school yearbook. It didn't become public knowledge because some reputable newspaper or journalistic source leaked it. It's out there. Because a questionable blog called Big League Politics released it. Big League Politics is the same source for the sexual assault allegations against Lieutenant Governor of Virginia, Justin Fairfax. In both cases, real journalists were forced to scramble to play catch-up in order to determine whether these things were true or not. Turns out that they were true. But the fact of the matter is, in many cases, the stuff gets out there, even if it's not true, before anybody can refute it. We are living in an age where truth and untruth become extremely difficult to distinguish. Technology, Photoshop, these kinds of technological innovations make it possible to sell things as being true that may not be. The whole issue of the Russian influence, Russian trolling of our elections in 2016 is based on the ideas that these Russian sources could plant stuff in our media that looked like they were legit, but they weren't. They put tens of thousands of things on Facebook that were political hit jobs that many Americans were swayed by. There's no question that the Russian influence on the 26th election campaign was significant. We know that. Mueller's 2 years of investigating has already produced enough evidence to indicate that the Russian influence on the 2016 election is significant. The fact that President Trump refuses to acknowledge it is because to do so raises the question of whether his election is legitimate or not. So he refuses to acknowledge it. But the fact is, we know it's there. We know that social media is able to deliver instantaneous news to millions of people before anybody has a chance to investigate whether it's true or whether it's false. That's the world we're dealing with. It's up to us to get a handle on it. We can't stop them. We don't want government to take over control and deny the freedom of access to the internet, because that would be a solution worse than the disease. We've got to basically educate our people to become more critical, to be more thoughtful, to be more careful, to not jump to conclusions, to not immediately share pieces of information they pick up on the internet, not knowing whether they're true or false, not knowing whether it's part of a political hit job or not. It's very obvious if you think about it. That this blog called Big League Politics clearly has an agenda. It releases the photograph of Governor Northam, and then is the source of the sexual abuse allegations against the lieutenant governor. This is a hit job against Democratic control of Virginia state government. Let's face it. But the fact of the matter is, it's legitimate. And if it's legitimate, why didn't we know it before? And the answer goes back to our local communities and the degree to which local media outlets don't have the budget, don't have the staff necessary to participate in legitimate journalism. Consequently, our local newspapers and our local media, our local news in the evening becomes a PR job. It becomes one half hour of advertising by local groups and local political leaders and local civic organizations that want to get out announcements to people about things and events that they're using for fundraising. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's not news. At least it's not the full package of news. Legitimate news requires more. And if they can't deliver it, then it's up to us to go after it. That's why this program, this network, the Head On Radio Network, what Bob Kincaid and Agnes are doing for us, is giving us access to the kind of information and the kind of perspective that all of us have to have in order to be able to function as informed, intelligent citizens in this republic. It's critical. We've got to do it. We don't have a choice. Our whole system depends on it. And what this historian at Princeton University has done with her research and her upcoming book on journalism, on blackface, excuse me, is to indicate to us how pervasive and how dangerous this kind of stuff is, because it's all around us to the point that we no longer can see it. It becomes part of our day-to-day lives. This attitude toward millions of people who happen to have a different skin color than others of us. And we left it up to them to make us aware of the wrong that we were condoning in our society. My God, that's embarrassing. It's sinful on our part. We owe our fellow man, our neighbors, and our fellow citizens more than that. We've got to force ourselves to become critical enough to see it. With that, as I look at the clock, we are right at the top of the hour, so we've kind of finished right on the button here today. Thank you again for your continued support. This is a tough program, I think you'll agree. The topic is sensitive. The issue is deep. It's important. I hope I was able to make the point and accomplish what I wanted to accomplish, which is to give us all something to think about. Please be aware of the different ways, the different avenues that you can utilize to communicate with me and with the rest of our listeners through the phone numbers and the call-ins to the network and all the network studios and all the rest of it. This is an important one. Don't let it pass. Thank you so very, very much. We look forward to being with you again tomorrow here at the Virtual Center. For Bob and Agnes and the folks at Head-On, this is Bill O'Brien thanking you very much. Thanking you for staying with us on this program today. It was a tough one. Thank you.